This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik. First, one program note. We had scheduled this week to talk about public health with Washington State Health Department Secretary John Wiesman. We'll air that next week instead. This week, the Spokane County Commissioners announced they're taking a measure off of the November ballot that would have asked taxpayers for permission to raise county property taxes by more than 1% next year. State law allows counties to increase property taxes up to 1% without a vote of the people. Anything more must be approved at the polls. Commissioner Al French says the board acted in response to the legislature's decision to increase state property taxes to raise significantly more money for public schools and satisfy a Supreme Court ruling.
If you're looking at already having a several hundred dollar increase in your property taxes next year, are you going to be voting your wallet or are you going to be voting your desires? And if people end up saying, you know what, next year, I'm already going to be taxed to death. I don't want to pay more taxes for any good reason. I get that.
French says the county surveyed the 7 largest school districts in the county to learn how much the state tax increase would impact homeowners next year. He says it found homeowners will pay between $150 and $170 more on average. And so the county decided to go with Plan B, keep local taxes as is this year and reduce spending instead.
We know that we've got about $9.5 million to cut out of our budget for next year. You know, with the criminal justice system being 75% of our budget, and with a lot of the other services that we provide being statutorily required, there's not a whole lot of wiggle room. So you're probably looking at quality of life programs like parks and conservation futures and some of those others that, you know, a lot of people, including myself, have really come to value. The question is, how much does community value them?
For that reason, French says the county's annual budgeting process will become much more open this year, so people can see the spending cuts the commissioners are proposing.
Typically, our budget adoption process involves a single hearing and nobody shows up and we pass it and we move on. That's not going to be the case this year. There's a lot of education that has to go on. We want to make sure that the public fully understands and appreciates what we're doing to try and be good stewards of their taxpayer dollars. And that means transparency, 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 not only in how we got here, but how we're going to work our way out and how we're going to chart a course forward.
That course forward will include negotiations with the city of Spokane about how to make more efficient some of those services the two provide and share.
When they arrest somebody, they come to our jail. And so we have a mutual responsibility in making sure that we keep the public safe.
Sheriff Ozzie Knezovich worries about that too. At a news conference held after the commissioner's decision to pull the ballot measure, Knezovich told reporters he's already at that point where service has been affected. He says there aren't many more efficiencies he can find.
Right now, I purchase used cars where there are patrolmen. We've been underfunded $1.6 million for the last 5 years. I told the Board of County Commissioners this January that if there is not a dynamic change in the way that we are doing things, we will lose control of crime in this area within 5 years. From 2008 to 2010, we lost 34 deputy positions. Those positions have never come back. With the $1.3 million cut that we're facing right now, it's another 8 to 15 deputies that could be lost during this next go-around. Commissioner said that you're going to have some public meetings. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for your voice to be heard.
Commissioner French says next year, the initial wave of state property tax increases will subside, and the county intends to go back to the ballot to raise the county taxes beyond the limit allowed without a public vote. Meanwhile, county leaders around the state who are in similar situations say they'll go back to Olympia to try to convince legislators to give local taxing districts more revenue options. French says it could be a matter of life or death.
There are counties in the state today that do not have 24/7 sheriff deputy coverage on their streets. If you're going to call the sheriff's office and get a deputy to show up, more than likely you're going to pull them out of bed because they can't afford to keep a deputy on the street 24/7. Now, we're not at that stage yet, but if something doesn't happen in terms of changing the economic paradigm that we're currently in, we could be at that stage.
The Spokane County Commissioners will hold the first two of at least 6 public budget workshops during their next 2 regularly scheduled Tuesday evening meetings. Children around the inland northwest will soon head back to school. Spokane's Central Valley School District is opening 1 new and 4 renovated schools this fall. Most of them were paid for by the $122 million bond issue approved by voters in 2015. The one facility not funded by that measure is the new school, Liberty Creek Elementary in Liberty Lake. On Tuesday, the district held a public dedication for that facility and opened it to tours. We went earlier in the day and met Superintendent Ben Small.
This is what I'm saying.
It's not often that a superintendent will take a visitor to a school library to show off the view. But Small says the big picture windows make the Liberty Creek Library a place you want to spend time.
There's the valley that Liberty Creek runs through, and so you get a view of that ravine that Liberty Creek runs down into the lake. And light, natural light coming in.
Little details like that, light from outside, can help a child learn, he says. And so the new schools were built to create an optimal learning environment. Natural light, comfortable temperatures, and quiet.
There's a study out of University of Washington that shows you can improve achievement by about 26% in that kind of environment when those conditions are met. And in many of our schools, open concept schools, we didn't have that environment. There were no doors or walls, and so controlling that that outside noise coming in and interfering with learning was very difficult. Well, it was non-existent, really. Very few windows to the outside, and our HVAC systems were old.
And now with those factors addressed, Small hopes the conditions are right for better learning. This is a school devoted to the youngest students, kindergarten through second grade, one of only a few such schools in the state.
The thing that's unique about Liberty Creek is that this school was paid for completely by a grant from the state of Washington for class size reduction.
That's nearly $21 million the district received from Olympia to help get its ratio down to 17 students per teacher, as mandated by the state for kindergarten through third grade classrooms.
It really does allow the youngest of our learners to have more individual attention from a teacher. When they're emerging as readers, they're emerging as mathematicians, they're emerging as scientists.
The grant has benefit for the district, too. It means Central Valley was able to preserve enough money to build another elementary school and help with construction of a new North Pines Middle School. Both will open next year. 4 remodeled schools will also welcome students this fall, Evergreen Middle School and Green Acres, Chester, and Sunrise Elementaries. Those will also have dedication ceremonies within the next few weeks. They join 4 other schools the district has finished and opened in the last 2 years. Collectively, they're significant additions to a district that for years couldn't convince its patrons to increase taxes to build new schools. A bond issue failed in 2011. All the while, growth in the valley was bringing thousands of new children to learn in aging facilities.
We said we have to go back. We have to do some things differently. We engaged our community differently. Over 4,000 people participated in a thought exchange, talking to us about what they felt their needs were in our district. And a couple of things came out. Our safety was a big concern for our families. And many of our schools were open concept schools. They had blind entryways to offices. So people had access to our children in our schools without some kind of secure entryway system. They also said, we want capacity. We're a growing school district. We don't want to bus our children across to different schools. We want our children to go to schools in neighborhoods that are close to them. And then finally they said, you know what, we want you to do that without a tax rate increase.
Finally, in February 2015, the district found the right formula. Nearly 65% of voters said yes to the current bond issue. Small hopes Central Valley is showing its patrons it can be trusted to wisely spend taxpayer money.
With, I think, schools that are designed that look nice, they're certainly not Taj Mahals, they're certainly not over-the-top buildings, but they're very nice. They're going to last for 30 to 40 years. They're going to serve communities as well as kids. There's opportunities for our communities to use these facilities after hours.
Small hopes that goodwill now built with patrons will pay off with the next bond issue, scheduled for the February 2018 ballot.
We have 3 major projects that will be included on that bond. It'll be a 3rd comprehensive high school, a renovation of Horizon Middle School, and then a new middle school in the Toledo Station area in the city of Liberty Lake. As we looked at that and get out and talk to people, now when they have questions, they have legitimate time that we can talk and explain.
Ben Small is the superintendent of the Central Valley School District. Next week, the district will hold two dedication ceremonies, Tuesday at Evergreen Middle School, Thursday at Green Acres Elementary. Ceremonies begin at 6, tours at 7. This summer, crews continue to remove mining waste from North Idaho's Silver Valley. It's a process that's been going for more than 30 years. Next year is expected to be an important one in Kellogg, as a private company hired by the federal government will begin building a new water treatment plant that will increase the amount of contaminated water that will be collected and processed. That means far fewer heavy metals being discharged into the South Fork of the Coeur d'Alene River. It will also mean much less contamination downstream, working its way toward Lake Coeur d'Alene. During that cleanup process, the Environmental Protection Agency and its federal, state, and local partners have also tried to track where that pollution is going and clean it up when feasible. That work will continue as well, maybe for generations. Yesterday, EPA officials leading the cleanup took a group of about 40 interested people on a bus tour to show their successes and challenges. Afterward, we talked with EPA Remedial Project Manager Ed Marine about what we saw. So a lot of that work's been done in the upper basin. How would you characterize the progress in that lower basin?
So we've really concentrated on gathering information and studying the river itself, studying flood events, developing models. So we're in the investigative mode for the most part. But we've also implemented some projects. We've taken some actions to protect people's health, such as hardening boat ramps in places where people recreate. That's a key component. We have, educational signage out there. We have brochures available that help people understand how they can play clean. And we've implemented, a large pilot project converting an agricultural field to a wetland. In our world, one of our goals in our record of decision is to create waterfowl habitat in places where waterfowl can feed without eating. High levels of lead. Lead is very toxic to waterfowl. We know that, and we see high mortalities in the Coeur d'Alene Basin. So that particular project is a great example of something where we've taken a parcel that was being operated for agricultural purposes. Now it's a wetland, and we can monitor, and other folks can operate that site to maintain safe habitat. And then there are other places where we don't even have contamination that exists, that wetlands have been created that are very near that same wetland complex. So those are the things that have been done. But we're talking about 18,000 acres of contaminated wetlands that have levels of lead that are toxic to waterfowl. And we're talking about having converted a little over 400 acres of wetland habitat. So as you can see, there's a very large chunk of the pie that is yet to be digested.
So I heard you invoke March 17th, and I assume that was this year, as a pretty important date. Tell me why that was important.
So we saw high flood flows on March 17th. It's one of the highest events that we've seen in the last 20 years. And it was actually a double humped hydrograph, which means the flows peaked on March 17th and they peaked again on March 20th. So we had a lot of water moving through the system and a lot of sediments, and in this case a lot of contaminated sediments that were mobilized and transported downstream into off-channel areas as well as Lake Coeur d'Alene.
And so those waters recede, they leave that sediment, people come and play with them. I think we went to Rose Lake or one of the areas of the campgrounds where we were probably walking in heavy metal laden. Are some of those areas unsafe for people to be in?
You know, the key to living and recreating in the Coeur d'Alene Basin is to do it smartly, to play clean. And that means that, one, you understand the risks out here, and two, that you take action to protect yourself. And they're pretty easy. Put a barrier between you and sediments, because they are likely to be contaminated. And then take actions to remove any sediments that you might pick up on your feet, that you carry to your vehicle, what have you. And you avoid having direct contact with soils, or directly eating soils, if you will, in essence mixing soils with the food that you eat, or having soils in your hands before you eat. So take actions to clean your hands. So again, it's back to pretty simple things. Remove the soil from your hands, leave the soil at the site, don't take it home with you. And if you do take it home with you, make sure you clean it off.
So is this basin going to be completely clean, let's say, in our lifetime? I mean, you and I are probably a little older, but how would you characterize over the next 20, 30 years how much progress is going to be made?
I'd love to tell you that it's all going to be cleaned up, but I think we have to be practical about what it is that we can do, how many resources we have at our disposal, and what kind of time frames we can achieve things in. And that's the thing that we're really starting to embark on right now, is to determine what kind of actions we can take. We know the riverbed is a big source of contaminated sediments. It's 37 river miles long. That's a big chunk. How do you address that in a way that we can actually measure progress and reduce the risk to you know, the ecosystem, to people and wildlife?
Could you dredge it completely and clean it out, or is that even physically possible?
Well, dredging in itself is possible. It takes a lot of resources. It's very expensive. It's very slow. And if you're going to dredge all those materials, let's say it's roughly 10 million cubic yards in the riverbed alone, you have to have someplace to put those, because you're now going to create a mountain, a waste mountain. And that's part of the logistical challenges here. But resources is probably your greatest constraint. It's going to be very expensive to dredge. And when you think about that size of an area, it's going to be very difficult to have enough resources to take that out.
So you're having to pick and choose what you do. And what are you probably talked about this, but what are the things that you most look at when you think about which project should we do versus another project?
Yeah, we want to think very strategically about how we address the problem. So first of all, you want to understand, where is the material being mobilized? Where is the highest concentrations being mobilized? What does that look like, literally? What is the physical nature of the riverbed or that source area? And then what are the measures you can take to address that? And also, what happens downstream if you do take measures? And those are all the things that we still have to let in front of us.
Ed Marine is a remedial project manager working on the Coeur d'Alene Basin cleanup for the Environmental Protection Agency. Monday's total solar eclipse might be the most studied disappearance of the sun ever, thanks in part to legions of citizen scientists from the Northwest and beyond. NASA, Cal Berkeley, and other institutions are recruiting volunteers to help with more than a half dozen science experiments tied to the celestial happening. In some cases, all you need to join the crowdsourced observing network is a smartphone or a ham radio, correspondent Tom Bonsi reports.
On the morning of the total eclipse, retired science teacher Bruce Montgomery plans to park his pickup truck in his brother-in-law's hayfield near Prineville, Oregon, while his extended family peers skyward with those funny eclipse viewing glasses. Montgomery will keep one eye on his portable ham radio.
Whiskey Alpha 7, Bravo Alpha Mike, needing a callback, needing a callback.
Montgomery is one of many amateur radio operators volunteering in a citizen science project to examine the ionosphere. Long-distance radio signals bounce off that layer of the upper atmosphere, which is influenced by solar radiation. Montgomery will transmit voice and data calls before, during, and after the eclipse. Automated receivers across the continent will measure how the moon's passage in front of the sun affects the propagation of the radio signals.
Yeah, I get excited about it. It's going to be good fun to participate in genuine scientific research and contributing to this body of knowledge, even though I can assure you that my small station will be a very small contribution.
All this time, though, the eclipse is going on. Don't you want to watch the eclipse?
I'll be able to see the effects of the eclipse. Okay. I'll have the windows down.
The ham radio experiment is just one of many avenues for non-scientists to take part in eclipse studies. Rihanna Mungin is a senior engineering student at Portland State University. She joined a student team that will deploy camera-carrying high-altitude weather balloons. They'll launch from Corvallis.
This balloon, we want it to go to at least 80,000 feet.
Dang, that's pretty.
Yeah.
I mean, that's way above where airplanes fly.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Airplanes, you know, maximum they're going about 39,000 feet. So we're going at least twice as high.
Theirs is one of more than 50 NASA-funded balloons, which will live stream the eclipse from its beginning off the Oregon coast, then follow it cross-country to the end out in the Atlantic. Mungin's team flight tested three additional balloons they plan to send to the edge of space to photograph the shadow of the moon as it races across Oregon.
You're going to be wherever you are during the eclipse. The sun's going to get blocked out. You'll be in total darkness, and then it'll come back up. But there's no context, right, for what's happening. You don't really see what's going on. So this is a way that it'll help change that perspective.
Slots in the Eclipse Ballooning Project are all taken, but there are other citizen science projects with unlimited capacity. A NASA video invites anyone with a smartphone and an outdoor thermometer to download an app and participate in a study about how much the temperature drops.
In the path of the eclipse, temperatures and clouds can change quickly. But exactly how they change is a question NASA scientists are trying to answer. If you'll be in North America during the August 23rd eclipse, you can help NASA collect data for...
Another smartphone-based experiment run by the California Academy of Sciences invites you to choose nearby plants or wild animals to observe immediately before, during, and after the eclipse. Then you report behavioral changes you see. Eclipse photographers can upload pictures of the total solar eclipse with location coordinates. The University of California, Berkeley, and Google will stitch those together into what they're calling a crowdsourced eclipse mega movie. I'm Tom Bonsi in Portland.
A replica of the Vietnam War Memorial is coming to Spokane Valley next week. KSPS, Spokane's public television station, is sponsoring the wall's visit in conjunction with Ken Burns' new PBS series that looks back at the Vietnam War. Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson reports.
It's known as the Wall That Heals and is a 250-foot-long replica of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. It bears the names of the more than 58,000 men and women who died in the war, including 244 from eastern Washington and northern Idaho. KSPS-TV spokeswoman Sandra Kernerman says the exhibit will be on display beginning Thursday the 24th through Sunday the 27th and will be viewable 24/7.
We are told that many people come in the night when there's not a lot of carrying on and commotion going on. We are striving to keep a very contemplative atmosphere for the duration of time that the wall is with us. We're not doing a lot of ongoing activities in the park while the wall is there. The Spokane Veterans Forum will be reading the regional names of the fallen each day at 10 and 6 p.m.
Kernerman says there will be a procedure for people who want to be able to find the names of a person on the wall and more information on the local casualties as well.
We will have the pictures of our regional people will be running on their monitors and whatnot. There's assistants looking up names. There's memorabilia that has been left at the wall that they manage all of that. So if people leave memorabilia, we don't throw it away or anything like that. That is managed professionally by the escorts of the wall.
The Wall That Heals will be viewable at Mirabeau Meadows in Spokane Valley. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. It's heard every Thursday at 5 p.m. here on KSFC. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Doug Nadvornik.